On November 22, 1963, President John F. Kennedy was shot and killed as his motorcade passed Dealey Plaza in Dallas. 2 hours later, Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson assumed the presidency. Today, we consider one of the great what-ifs in American history. What if Kennedy had survived to win re-election in 1964 and serve a second term? How would he have managed U.S. military intervention in Vietnam, or civil rights, or the Cold War? Emmy Award-winning political analyst Jeff Greenfield teases out those scenarios in a book that imagines an alternate history for the nation in the 1960s. Jeff Greenfield and If Kennedy Lived, next on Midday After the News. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us on WYPR. During this hour of the show, we're turning back the clock for an extended thought experiment. The day we'll turn to is November 22nd, 1963. It's Dallas. The sun is shining. President John F. Kennedy is riding in a presidential motorcade in an open-top convertible. With him is the First Lady, Jacqueline Kennedy, the Texas Governor, John Connally, and Governor Connally's wife, Nellie. Onlookers watch as the president waves to them as his motorcade makes its way past Dealey Plaza in downtown Dallas. But shortly after noon, sounds of gunshots are heard throughout the plaza, and bullets strike President Kennedy. 30 minutes later, the president is pronounced dead. So let's stop here for a moment and consider a couple of questions. What if John F. Kennedy, had survived those gunshots? What if he had made it through that day to live out the course of his first term? And what if he had been reelected in 1964 and went on to serve a second term? How would he have managed U.S. military intervention in Vietnam, the Cold War, civil rights? My guest in this hour is the Emmy Award-winning political analyst, columnist, author of several books, Jeff Greenfield. He takes on these what-ifs in this book, If Kennedy Lived, the First and Second Terms of President John F. Kennedy, an Alternate History. Jeff Greenfield says that for most historians, creating an alternate history is at best a parlor game and at worst a nuisance. But he feels differently and recognizes the small twists of fate that happened around us every day, shaping the moments that can change our future. His book reimagines how John F. Kennedy's survival could have affected the 1960s, which became, of course, one of the most turbulent decades in American history. Jeff Greenfield's five-time Emmy Award-winning political commentator and analyst. He's been a correspondent for CBS, ABC, CNN, PBS, a columnist for Time magazine, a political strategist, a speechwriter once upon a time, several books. He's written 13 books. This one that we're talking about today is, again, If Kennedy Lived, the First and Second Terms of President John F. Kennedy, an Alternate History. Jeff Greenfield, welcome to the Midday Show on WYPR. It's a pleasure to get you on our air.
Nice to be here with you, even from a distance.
Yeah, Jeff, a longtime admirer of your work from back in the days. When did I first see you on television? Was it CBS Sunday Morning? When did I see you for the first time?
That could be actually even earlier than that. At a very young age, long ago, I was a sometime examiner of William F. Buckley on Fire in Lawn. But the first work I did was on Sunday Morning in its first few years I was there as their media critic or commentator.
That's right,
or
yeah.
Something.
That's right. That's my first awareness of your work, and it stood out then. It continues to stand out. Back in the days of Charles Kuralt, it was.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. You know, this question, I mean, do you have to be a Kennedy fan to ponder this question? I don't know.
Right? No. I think this is certainly for me not an exercise in idolatry or hagiography at all. Mm-hmm. As in fact, readers of this book will learn, it's something I've done in a couple of other books. It's always fascinated me that in personal lives and in history, very small twists of fate can produce enormous consequences. In personal life, you know, I know how I met my wife. It was a kind of a random chance. Everybody has stories like that. How you went into your life's work. And historically, it turns out that for all of the validity of historians looking at great movements or geography or guns, steel, and whatever, or natural resources, there are times, more often I think than we realize, when the smallest little twist of fate, that butterfly flapping its wings thousands of miles away, can wind up producing hugely consequential differences. And so in looking at this question, what I was trying to do was do what is now called, I guess, in journalism, a deep dive into what we know about the world back then 51 years ago, what we know about the character of John Kennedy and those around him, and try to make some sense out of how his survival might reasonably have been seen to have had significant effects. And you don't have to have, in my view, a particular point of view to decide that this is an exercise worth doing.
And you could even use those that theory of yours or that belief of yours in twists of fate to build a case of why John F. Kennedy became president. He might not have become president had it not been for four, five, six, seven different things.
Oh, indeed. I mean, that's one of the things that struck me about John Kennedy. Had he not made a phone call to the wife of Martin Luther King, who was jailed on a trumped-up parole violation charge, I think in Georgia, and had that not persuaded King's father, who had endorsed Richard Nixon because he didn't like the idea of a Catholic in the White House, to switch his support, and had that not turned out a great number of African-American voters in some key states, that alone would probably have made Richard Nixon president.
In 1960.
Yeah. And then a few months after he was elected, and I dealt with this in an earlier book, he narrowly escaped being killed by a suicide bomber parked outside his Palm Beach, Florida home. And only the fact that Jackie Kennedy had come to the door to see her husband off stayed the hand of this man, Richard Pavlik. Now, had she not come to the door, he had enough dynamite in his car to level a mountain, we would never have had a President Kennedy.
Jeff, do you mind stopping there for a moment? That's an amazing story. I'm not sure how many people are aware of this one. She came to the door to see John F. Kennedy off. This was at their Palm Beach house.
Right. He was working on his inaugural.
Right.
This guy, Richard Pavlik, who had a deep anti-Catholic animus and had also believed that the Kennedys had stolen the election, drove down to Palm Beach in a car loaded with dynamite. The Secret Service took no notice of him. He was going to ram the car of Kennedy on his way to church and then trigger the dynamite. In an earlier book, Then Everything Changed, I lay out that alternate history. But my point being, when you add that to the fact that he almost died in World War II, mm-hmm. he almost died on an operating table in 1954, he came very close to losing the nomination. It was only Lyndon Johnson's lack of decisiveness in any end of the race that probably got him the nomination. And as I say, he won the closest election by popular vote in American history, and there are many people, they have to be old at this point, who think that he did not win that election fairly.
Right.
So there are all these twists of fate that got him to the White House. And then you pointed out in your introduction what for me was the really quite chilling notion. It had rained all weekend. It was going to rain all weekend in Dallas. The weather was bad. And just as Kennedy flew into Dallas, the skies cleared. And the Secret Service, knowing that Kennedy wanted to be seen by crowds, said, okay, let's take the bubble top off the limo. The bubble top wasn't bulletproof, but had it been on, it would have been a much tougher shot for the assassin. Mm-hmm. And that first shot would have alerted the people driving the car that something was amiss. In real life, remarkably and horrifyingly, the driver of that car slowed down because he thought it was a backfire. So if you just change that one little twist of fate, if the weather had done what the forecaster said, his chances of surviving the assassination would have been immeasurably greater.
And Jeff, one last thing about that. The route of the motorcade itself, didn't that change? And did Lee Harvey Oswald have notice of a change in the direction of the motorcade?
Well, it depended on where the luncheon was to be held. Some of Kennedy's people wanted it held at a low-cost, very accessible place. John Connally, the governor of Texas, the leader of the conservative faction, wanted the luncheon to be a much more kind of elite affair. held at a particular kind of location that took the motorcade right past the Texas School Book Depository. One of the reasons why I've come to believe that the conspiracy theories are not to be believed is there was no way for anybody to know where that motorcade was going until relatively close to the actual event.
Mm-hmm.
When you add to the fact that that job that Oswald got in the school book depository was a kind of a matter of happenstance gotten for him by his landlady, the conspiracy theories look a lot weaker. But yes, had the luncheon been held in a different place, it would have been a much different issue for whether or not there was a clear shot at a president riding through downtown Dallas.
So for the purposes of this exercise, which led to this book, If Kennedy Lived, you rely heavily on plausibility, and you do not skip around the fact that John F. Kennedy went to Dallas and was in this motorcade. So just give us a little bit of the scenario there. Does he survive the shooting? There's actually – is a shot taken at the president and he survives?
Yes, but with the bubble top on, my alternate scenario, the weather doesn't clear. The bubble top stays on. The first shot shatters the bubble top and it wounds the president. The driver and the Secret Service chief in the car immediately realize that there's an assault going on and speed away, depriving Oswald of a chance for the fatal shot. And he survives. And I actually base what follows on what really happened with Ronald Reagan, who came very close to bleeding out in 1981 when he was shot by John Hinckley. And that is that during the course of the recovery, there's this enormous reservoir of goodwill that surrounds the president because, whatever your politics, the country wants to see its president not taken out in a murderous act.
And when Ronald Reagan was shot, 1981, I think we were still in a bit of a recession there, were we not? After that,
yes.
I'm not saying he benefited from being shot, but you're saying there was a great deal of goodwill that came to Ronald Reagan.
What happens in a situation like that, the other thing about Reagan was that, after a spate of shootings of John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy earlier, he survived. And there was a sense of, I think, enormous relief, mm-hmm. whatever your politics, that he had survived this. So I'm just – when I do these alternate histories, I try to reach into real life as much as possible and look at the fact that John Kennedy was – facing a tricky reelection. I mean, in the half century since, there's this notion we have that he was widely, almost universally supported. He was going to face a difficult contest because he had lost the South over civil rights, because there was a lot of anger at him in traditional Democratic white working class neighborhoods in big cities because of all kinds of tensions, including racial. He said he believed that if he could face Goldwater, then as he said shortly before he left for Dallas, I wouldn't have to leave the White House. But they were very worried about the candidacy, believe it or not, of George, not Mitt, George Romney, the governor of Michigan, moderate to liberal Republican.
Mm-hmm.
He would have posed a very difficult threat to Kennedy in terms of 1964. But I believe, and I use in the book Goldwater's nomination, which I think would have been inevitable because the rise of the conservatives in the Republican Party by 1963 and 4 had become so pronounced that they basically controlled the grassroots of the party. And under those circumstances, I may be leaping ahead here, I apologize, even the difficulties that John Kennedy faced I think would have been trumped by the peace issue. The Goldwater's views on foreign policy and nuclear weapons, I think, just as they were in real life, would have proven simply unacceptable to large parts of the American public.
Okay. So you have to remember, this is the Cold War, and the civil rights movement there is underway. It's 1963, but John Kennedy survives, and he runs for re-election in 1964, and you believe he would have faced Goldwater, and Goldwater would have used the same messaging that he used against Lyndon Johnson.
Yes.
Okay.
Basically calling for a much more aggressive action in Vietnam, deploring the no-win policy, accusing Kennedy of weakness in dealing with the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really significant to me that when you read the speeches John Kennedy was giving in the last 2 months of his life and contrast them to the hawkish speeches he was giving when he first ran in 1960, it's like listening to two different people. Some conservatives had claimed that John Kennedy was essentially a conservative, that he was very militant about the Soviet Union, and all that was true until the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it's my belief that he came out of the Cuban Missile Crisis, as, by the way, did Soviet leader Khrushchev, really shaken by the closeness of a nuclear war. And that's when I think things began to change. And all of his tactics in terms of talking to the public at the end of his life were about the need to tamp down the Cold War, find areas of agreement with the Soviet Union, and begin to move away from the precipice that had almost taken us into nuclear war.
Jeff, we're going to take a break here. I got a million questions for you. I hope we have time for them all. We'll take a break and come back and talk with Jeff Greenfield more about this scenario, this alternate history he presents in this book, If Kennedy Lived, the First and Second Terms of President John F. Kennedy, an Alternate History. So if you have a question for Jeff, feel free to call us here at midday, the local number, 410-662-8780, toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. Or you can send a question by email, midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to Midday. We have the pleasure of the company of Jeff Greenfield this hour, a longtime political commentator, senior political correspondent for network television, and author. His latest book, If Kennedy Lived, The First and Second Terms of President John F. Kennedy, an Alternate History. And you've done this before. The earlier book from a couple of years ago, Jeff, you mentioned it, Then Everything Changed, presents alternate histories of also RFK and who else? Who else?
Yes, I have Bobby Kennedy living and winning. I mean, I worked for him for the last year of his life, so that was almost like therapy. Yeah. And then Gerry Ford remembering not to prematurely liberate Poland and thus defeating Jimmy Carter. Right. And thus producing all kinds of ripple effects, yeah. See, that's one thing about – I just have to mention how easy it is to forget the reality of elections. Once somebody's elected, we kind of think it was like a natural law. Gerry Ford lost that election by the skin of his teeth. If he'd gotten about 6,000 more votes in Ohio and another few thousand in Mississippi, he would have won the presidency the way Bush did, by losing the popular vote. It was really close. And as historians and people who know history know, John Kennedy beat Richard Nixon in 1960 by 0.1% of the popular vote. And in many of those critical states I mentioned earlier, New Jersey, I think, Michigan, Pennsylvania, the margin was 1 or 2%. And that's why I'm so interested in this kind of field, because you realize – I once wrote that history doesn't turn on a dime, it turns on a plugged nickel. How often we could have had a very different life.
So let's go back to 1963, after this assassination attempt on John F. Kennedy in your alternate history. And it takes place in Texas. So any ramifications, are there any ramifications for Lyndon Johnson, his vice president, because of the location of this attempted assassination?
It's not so much because of the location, but the first consequence that I offer as an alternate history is that Lyndon Johnson is forced out of the vice presidency. If you look at Robert Caro's, I guess, latest book, I hope it's not his last, he's got a whole presidency to cover. The very day, literally the very day that John Kennedy was riding through Dallas on November 22nd, 1963, there were two investigations going on, one by Life magazine, into how this lifelong public servant had accumulated a massive net worth, $14 million,
LBJ.
Which in those days was real money.
You're talking about LBJ
now, Johnson.
Right? Yeah.
And then, yes, and then in on Washington, a Senate committee was investigating evidence that Johnson had personally taken kickbacks from a guy who had written an insurance policy on his life. Now, when Kennedy was killed, these investigations were immediately put aside. Nobody wanted to shake up an already deeply shaken country with the notion that the incoming president of the United States might have legal or ethical dilemmas. But my argument is, had Kennedy lived, the reverse would have happened. The Senate committee and Life magazine would have said, my Lord, this guy almost became president. We've got to get the facts out. And because the facts were so damning, my suggestion is that Lyndon Johnson would have been forced from office within a few months after Kennedy had Kennedy survived.
Wow. For those reasons, we can't keep you because of the corruption allegations.
Because, in other words, instead of saying we can't expose this because the country can't take another shock to the system, I believe that the magazine and the Senate committee would have said we can't have this guy a heartbeat from the White House.
Okay. So then John F. Kennedy selects a new running mate.
Now, remember, he doesn't pick a vice president for a year because there's no 25th Amendment then. If the vice presidency is vacant, it stays vacant until 1964.
Oh, okay. So what happens in 1964?
You know what? Let me.
You want to skip around that?
Let me leave that to the readers.
You can do that. You can do that. Okay.
As long married couples say, there has to be some mystery.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm with you on that. Jeff Greenfield's book is If Kennedy Lived, the First and Second Terms of President John F. Kennedy. I'm going to go to a comment that we received just before the show on my Facebook page, Jeff, where we posted a notice of your being a guest today. Jarrett writes to us to say, pertaining to the Civil Rights Act, I'm not sure if civil rights legislation would have passed if John F. Kennedy had been president, had survived into 1964. Progressive or controversial legislation takes political authority, horse trading, arm twisting, blackmail, bullying within Congress, and I'm not sure if JFK could deliver as LBJ did.
Is that Jarrett who wrote that?
Jarrett. Yeah,
Jarrett. Well, he's a very perceptive thinker because that's exactly what I hypothesize. In 1964, there are a couple of things at stake. First, Johnson was a Southerner, and even the Southerners opposed to civil rights at some level had a kind of almost blood tie to him. Second, and this is really important, Johnson had the legacy of a slain President Kennedy as a very powerful emotional lever with which to advance civil rights. And the third thing was he knew the Congress better than anybody. And the Kennedy administration was not particularly skilled in legislative work. So for that and other reasons which involve the plot of the book, I think it would have been very difficult for John Kennedy to get the Civil Rights Act, that was the Public Accommodations Act that opened up restaurants and hotels, passed. So I think that point's exactly right. Now, after a reelection in 1965, the Voting Rights Act, I think, would have happened because the right to vote is so basic. Even as Johnson himself once said, even racists who don't want to sit down with a black person and have a cup of coffee, I mean, 50 years ago, have a very hard time explaining why black people shouldn't be allowed to vote. Mm-hmm. So that one, I think he could have, in his second term, he could have pulled off.
I'm curious about political consequences of a second term for JFK, aside from legislative, the political. The Southern strategy that developed, late in the 60s, early 70s, for Republicans running in the South, to win back the South from the Southern Democrats. What would have been the consequences of a second Kennedy term, do you think?
I think they would have been what Lyndon Johnson is alleged to have said when he signed the Civil Rights Act. I'm not ever sure if that's apocryphal, but he is alleged to have said, we've just given the South to the Republican Party for a generation. Mm-hmm. And I think that would have been even more pronounced with Kennedy because you remember in 1964, Johnson did lose a bunch of deep South states to Goldwater. I think Kennedy would have lost virtually the entire South to Goldwater, and I think the Democrats would have been in the same kind of very difficult shape for years after. And I think, at least at the beginning, race was the animating reason why.
Right.
Today, 50 years later, it's a little more complicated. It's not quite as cut and dry, but certainly the Civil Rights Act, whoever signed it, or the Voting Rights Act would have, I think, produced tremendous, as they called it, backlash, particularly in the South, to the Democrats. The Kennedys were – there was one poll that was taken before Kennedy died that showed him losing the South to, I think, any Republican by 20 points. You know, the entire South.
Right, right. Let's talk about Vietnam a little bit, Jeff, because this is very interesting. If anyone's seen the Oliver Stone version of the JFK assassination and what the consequences were, or why JFK was killed, almost every conspiracy theory you've ever heard of distilled into one motion picture. It's kind of amazing, actually. Military-industrial complex plays a role in this. Oliver Stone suggesting that Kennedy was killed so that the generals and big industry that services our Defense Department could have its war in Vietnam.
Right.
Yeah. So, and then we've heard other people say Kennedy wanted to get us out of Vietnam. There was an executive order that was going to go through the next day, but he was killed in Dallas. So help us out.
Well, if I can put aside conspiracy theories, and I do bring the kind of defense intelligence complex into my book, but in a different way that if we have time, I'll explain to you. This requires, I think, really reading into the history of the time. And I was greatly helped by a book-length version of a gathering that was held in 2005 by a group of historians, policymakers, writers, solely devoted to the question of what would Kennedy have done in Vietnam. It's a book called Virtual Kennedy. It contains all kinds of once-classified documents, different assessments, and there's not a unanimity. But I would say there was something of a consensus that the probabilities are that Kennedy would have looked for a way to carefully, cautiously, politically, shrewdly way to back out of Vietnam and not commit massive forces. There's no question that he ratcheted up the commitment in his first couple of years with what became 15,000 American advisors who were more than advisors. But if you look at what did Kennedy think about that region? He'd gone there as a congressman in 1951 and was struck by the force of nationalism and the futility of the French effort back then to keep their Vietnam colony. He, over the course of his presidency, from the Bay of Pigs to the missile crisis to Berlin, he'd gotten progressively more skeptical about the power of the military to do what it claimed it could do, as well as the wisdom of many military officials in what they wanted to do. He had advisors, many of the advisors around him were like Bundy, like Rusk, like Walt Rostow, were hawks. But he also listened to people like Senate Leader Mike Mansfield, who'd lived in the region and who kept telling Kennedy this would be a fool's errand, it would be a disaster. He often said, and there are many quotes from, I'm talking about real life now, not my book, that Kennedy said, there's nothing I can do there until I'm reelected. Because he felt that if he pulled out of Vietnam, he would, in fact, be successfully labeled as an appeaser or as a defeatist. But the best evidence we have is that after 1964, he would have looked for a way to slowly and carefully disengage. And I think had his presence, had his survival meant the political survival of Soviet leader Khrushchev, which I argue it might have, you would have seen in Vietnam something of what happened in real life earlier in Laos, where Khrushchev and Kennedy kind of cryptically agreed, keep the temperature down. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is the most likely possibility. And as you alluded to in your introduction, that's where I think you would have seen some really significant changes in the whole culture of the late 1960s.
Well, I mean, think about it. If you don't have – take the divisive Vietnam War out of the 1960s, history tells us, obviously, we have assassination, we have civil unrest, we have a cultural change. But you take the war out of it. I mean, I can't even imagine. It's so hard to imagine because we live through it.
This is how I describe it. The counterculture would have emerged because that was baked in the cake. You would have had sex, drugs, and rock and roll, right. Thank God. But what you would not have had was the belief that the country was in the grip of malevolent forces. I talked to a couple of old radicals, including Tom Hayden, and it's easy to forget that in 1964, SDS, the emerging left group, endorsed Lyndon Johnson for re-election. Their slogan was "Part of the Way with LBJ," and it was more than anything else the escalation of the war that turned what would have been a kind of contentious time into something much grimmer. I mean, the whole notion of a weather underground of America spelled with three K's, I think would have been dramatically different. I think you would have had much more of a kind of a mainstream protest movement and people moving into trying to do something about poverty, even within the boundaries of the government. I asked Tom Hayden, what would you have done had Kennedy lived and there not been a Vietnam? He said, I think I probably would have gone to work for the war on poverty. Hmm. So that whole emergence of that darker side of the counterculture doesn't happen. In other words, you have grass, but maybe you don't have speed. Maybe you don't have – it's that kind of attempt to –
Well, what happens – I wonder what happens to the Cold Warrior's voice who says domino effect, you know, domino theory, lose Vietnam, lose all of Southeast Asia.
Well,
what about that?
This is where I start to – this is where I have to admit that the fiction person in me takes over. what I posit is that the people who were angry with Kennedy disengaging in Vietnam – some people fairly high up in the Defense Department, in the military, in the intelligence community, in that whole Cold War enterprise, would have looked for a way to disarm Kennedy. And my belief is they would have used his private life.
Ah, I was going to ask
because
you about that.
Because we forget – here's something else that is widely lost to history. There is this notion that, well, the press didn't write about Kennedy's private life because back then nobody did. Well, the fact is – that just in the weeks before Kennedy went to Dallas, there were several reporters who were looking very hard at accusations about John Kennedy's behavior because one of them involved his assignation with a woman who was believed to be an East German spy, and the other one that J. Edgar Hoover knew about was his involvement with a woman who was also the mistress of a powerful Chicago mafia don. Those kinds of stories aren't, even back then, would not have been considered private. And back at the time, Robert Kennedy, who was basically in charge of trying to keep this stuff quiet, was working overtime to try to keep these stories out of the press. So it's my belief that had Kennedy emerged as a full-blown anti-Cold Warrior, the people within the intelligence community, I don't think they would have resorted to assassination, but I think they would have resorted to trying to get this stuff out to make John Kennedy perhaps have to leave the White House. Remember, we're talking about a time when sexual mores were very different. And the idea of a president recklessly cohabiting with any number of women, some of whom could have been security threats, what happened was I asked Michael Beschloss, could Kennedy have survived this politically? And he said, I can't imagine that. So I said, what then? He said, well, you're the writer. Figure out some way the Kennedys would have tried to keep this out of the press. Which I did in the book.
Okay. Oh, you do in the book. Okay.
Oh, yes.
Okay. All right. Good. We're going to stop here for a minute, take another break. And, Jeff, I want to talk to you about some current events, too, if that's okay.
Sure. Absolutely.
We invite your calls here, folks. We can talk to Jeff Greenfield more about his alternate history, if Kennedy lived, but also about what's happened in Washington just in the last 24 hours or so. 410-662-8780. I have a number of questions for Jeff about President Obama and the Republicans. Maybe you do, too. 410-662-8780 is the number for The Midday Show here on WYPR. Back on Midday with Jeff Greenfield. His latest book, If Kennedy Lived, The First and Second Terms of President John F. Kennedy, An Alternate History, New American Libraries, the publisher. Jeff, this is in soft cover now?
Yes, just came out as a paperback.
Yeah. So back to Kennedy's vices and his private life, questions about his the relationships with these one, a woman who might have been an East German spy, and then Sam Giancana's girlfriend, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm trying to think of the press at the time. It's 1964, 1965. Is there much investigative reporting going on? Isn't the press still in sort of its reverent robes standing there as the president has a private life and looking the other way? Isn't that the era when wasn't Ben Bradley in the White House then and going sailing with the president? And
well, it certainly was a different environment. And it is true that in general, what were considered private behaviors were often kept private, not just sex. But I remember when I was working in the Senate, I'd gone down to the Senate floor to give something to, I guess, Robert Kennedy, for whom I was working. And Russell Long, who was he may have been Senate Majority Leader then or Senate Majority Whip, Senator from Louisiana, was there clearly three sheets to the wind. And this, everybody knew that he had a huge drinking problem. Nobody wrote about it. But as I mentioned before the break, even when Kennedy was alive, there were a couple of stories that were beginning to surface just cryptically about powerful executive branch officials. And Bobby Kennedy at one point had to summon a couple of reporters in to warn them, you know, you're barking up the wrong tree. This fellow, Clark Mollenhoff from the Des Moines Register, a very tough investigative journalist who was plaguing the Kennedys on public stuff like defense contracts, was on to this story about these party girls that it was actually Bobby Baker, I guess, running them out of a townhouse in Washington. So the answer is yes, in general, there was a kind of wall of separation, but it was not unbreachable. And the other part about this, however, without giving too much away, is there were weapons that a president could use to bully the press. I mean, the picture that I paint, look, I worked for Robert Kennedy. I'm a huge admirer. But you have to remember, I'm really addressing your point, when the steel companies raised their prices in 1962, which John Kennedy thought had been a violation of a solemn agreement, the tactics, the tools that the administration used to bring the steel producers into line were shocking to me when I read about them. Wiretaps, looking at the tax returns of steel company executives to see if they could ferret out private immoral behavior or threats of antitrust violation. And what I concluded was if the administration had done that to roll back a steel price hike, what would they have done to keep in office?
Right.
And it isn't a pretty picture.
Right. Very interesting. A question by email came in, Jeff, from Christopher, one of our listeners, wondering about the CIA. How do you feel that the CIA would have fared under a Kennedy second term? I don't know if you wrestle with that or not if Kennedy lived.
Not so much, but I think I know what he's getting at. I think what I'm talking about is a second term that would have seen a radical shift in how a competition with the Soviet Union would have gone forward. You know, there was no question that the Kennedy spent a lot of time trying to undermine Fidel Castro's government. There are indications that late in life, Kennedy was interested in seeing if there was an alternative approach to Cuba, having come close to nuclear war because of Cuba. There are reasons to think that he would have made, and this is kind of interesting, Robert Kennedy defense secretary, because if he was going to revamp the military, he wanted somebody the military knew was speaking for him. Mm. And it's entirely possible that you would have seen a second Kennedy term moving away from the more controversial kinds of wet work of, you know, attempting to undermine governments and stuff like that. Because I kind of think that Kennedy learned a lesson from the Bay of Pigs.
You mentioned that earlier. That's very interesting. Yeah. It didn't soften him, but soften isn't the word. But he was.
No, I think
he was,
it made him, he made him skeptical.
Skeptical. I mean, interested in peace. More interested in peace.
I think that's the striking thing is that he gave a speech at American University in June of 1963. Which, when contrasted to how he ran for president, is absolutely mind-boggling. Where he's not saying, you know, let's all get together and sing folk songs. It's not that. He had there was no illusion about the Soviet Union, but it's we have areas of agreement that we can reach to lessen the danger of war. And, you know, we all breathe the same air. We're all mortal.
Right.
Those are not statements saying there's no difference between us, but that there are certain things we share in common, and one of them is the desire to survive and not see, you know. There are really striking comments during the Cuban Missile Crisis where Kennedy keeps talking about the children, you know, that the people who have no responsibility at all for what's going on here and may lose their lives by the millions. And I just think that had a very significant impact on how he regarded what he wanted to do with the presidency.
And, Jeff, do you put echoes of that into Kennedy's second inaugural speech, which you get to write in your book?
Yes. Was one of the – you know, I don't do these things without having a certain amount of fun. So I get not only to write his second inaugural address, I get him to meet the Beatles. I get some rock and roll performers to perform at the second inaugural. There are things that happen throughout the book where I actually I'm winking at the reader, saying,
sure,
okay, I'm having a little fun here.
That also sounds very, very plausible. If Kennedy lived, Jeff Greenfield's latest book, now in softcover, The First and Second Terms of President John F. Kennedy, an Alternate History. So to present history, Jeff, and what's happening now, I can't resist asking you about things just from the last 24 hours or so. The president's speech on immigration being greeted by John Boehner today, the Speaker of the House, saying that the president was damaging the presidency itself by using his executive authority to prevent the deportation of millions of undocumented immigrants. And then 10 a.m. this morning or so, the House Republicans filing this lawsuit that they had threatened for a long time over the Health Care Act, the ACA, saying that the president has abused his executive authority there as well. So we're not into the new Congress quite yet, but there's signs that this is going to be a rough road the next couple of years. I'm interested in your take on this.
Well, I think that's a – I just heard what I would classify as one of the understatements of this fiscal quarter. I was on Morning Joe this morning, and I know sounded very dyspeptic because I simply take all these first kind of anodyne comments like, well, you know, we're going to try to find a way to cooperate. No, that's not what's going to happen. It hasn't happened for years. Whatever your sense of who's responsible, and this divides up so much on partisan lines, it's almost impossible to make a statement that somebody isn't going to jump on. I think Norm Ornstein and Thomas Mann, two longtime Washingtonians, one from a Republican think tank, one from a Democratic one, who've written a book. I think it's called It's Worse Than You Think.
That's right. Yeah.
And basically, their argument is that while both parties have become polarized, the Republican Party has become far more clear-cut as not only a conservative party, but a party that is driven by the belief that they do not want this president to get what he wants. And supposedly there was a meeting, I think it was the day after Obama's inaugural, where the Republicans said as a strategy, we can't give him a bipartisan agreement. We have to resist. And from their point of view, they're resisting because they don't like his policies. The point about this is that far from suffering for being labeled as an obstructionist party, the Republicans in the last two midterms have done quite well. And the ranks of the Senate and the House get progressively more militant in terms of saying, we don't want to work with this guy. He's pursuing a terrible agenda. It's our job to stop him. And I think in some sense, whether he meant to or not, and there are some people who think he did, Obama's action has been a powerful provocation for those Republicans to say, you see, he's doing what he said 22 times he couldn't do and didn't have the power to do. This is a direct assault on us. It's a refusal to recognize the midterms, so we're going to be even more tough.
Right.
And what all that leads to, I think, is outside of maybe a trade agreement, the idea of if you were a betting person and you got the over-under on what percent of of the next year would be cooperative and what would be confrontational, I'm betting the confrontational.
Yeah, why would they change? You've just laid it out perfectly there. I've said this to somebody the other night. Well, they won the last two elections, so why would they change? I mean, they didn't win the presidency, but look what they've done with the House and now the Senate.
And so, they probably have the House. I think the Republicans, not just because of redistricting, that's a part of it, because of the nature of how House districts vote, they probably have the House sewn up for probably into the 2020s.
But Jeff, let me ask you this, though. Given the success that he just had in this election, going into the next into January in the next Congress, why this obsession with Obama? It's almost like an obsession with Obama and his legacy. In 2006, the Democrats got control in 2006, and they pretty much declared George Bush irrelevant and moved on. Right? Republicans aren't doing that.
Well, for one thing, I mean Charles Krauthammer, the fine conservative columnist and a psychiatrist, jokingly referred to back then what he called Bush derangement syndrome, which was Democrats thinking that Bush was something of a secular antichrist. Well, there are some Republicans who don't even take the secular. look, I think what you're seeing is the progressive, I'll call it militancy, of a part of the Republican base does not see Obama as their opponent. They see him as the enemy. It's a great line from Robert Dole's acceptance speech in 96 where he said, Bill Clinton is not my enemy, he's my opponent. Well, I think today you wouldn't get away with that. And, I live in Southern California mostly. So I listen to a lot of talk radio, which is mostly from the right because that's where talk radio is very successful. Mm-hmm. There's not a line about why don't we work together. He's a closet socialist. He's a radical. He doesn't really understand America. The health care program is socialized medicine. And the immigration, both the policy of and the way he did it, is a direct affront to American values and the American system of government. So if you think that way, it's not only politically silly to compromise, it's not what you should do. When you listen to people running for office, it happened in 2010 and 2014, there was nothing hidden about this. Many of these successful candidates said, I am not going to Washington to legislate. I am going to block legislation. I'm going to, as Bill Buckley once said famously when he founded the National Review, I want to sit athwart history saying stop. We need to stop this man because if he succeeds, it will destroy America. Now, obviously, for many of your listeners, this is Obama derangement syndrome.
Right.
But I think that's where we are politically. I take no joy in saying it. But all the people who point to, hey, remember when Reagan and Tip O'Neill had a drink after work and remember when Gingrich and Clinton got together? This is not your father's Washington.
No, that was 30 years ago. And it certainly wasn't the era of John F. Kennedy and Mike Mansfield and name a Republican quick.
Ev Dirksen.
Everett Dirksen of that era, yeah. Well, Jeff, I've so enjoyed our conversation. I want to thank you for making time for us here on the Midday Show at WYPR, good old Baltimore.
And we'll tell it was a pleasure.
Yeah.
It was a pleasure.
Great.
Thank you.
The book is If Kennedy Lived. It's now in softcover. The first and second terms of President John F. Kennedy in alternate history. Then Everything Changed is Jeff's book from a couple years ago. Thanks again, Jeff.
All right. Thank you. Yep. Bye-bye.
Have a great weekend. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's our midday for today and for this week. I want to thank Matt Taka for sitting in this week at our board and serving as engineer. And to all our staff. And I hope you all have a great weekend coming up. And we'll see you again back here on Monday, midday, weekly, every day. Daily. Noon to 2, daily here on WYPR with lunch served. If you're in the neighborhood, please stop by sometime. Okay, have a great weekend, everybody. I'll see you soon.
Today's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Hemowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richman, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineers are Matt Taka and Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.